First of all, let me just say that there are obviously, I think for most of us, a lot of ways in which the being out in the wilderness or taking hikes or somehow or another being engaged with nature is spiritually empowering. And I want to say from the beginning that I don't plan to spend the whole hour sort of going through all those different ways. I want to focus on one or two particular things. But it is very clear that that nature and wilderness is for many people a very powerful spiritual experience. And in fact, Elmer Witt, our director, often does sessions on creation-centered spirituality, he calls it. And just talking about some of these things and how through history our perceptions of creation and how we've learned from creation and how we see God in creation has changed. And he often starts some of those sessions by simply asking people where in their lives have they most experienced God. And usually he says that it runs about 70 to 80% of people who say out of all sorts of experiences with different people and whatever, that nature is part of that. Now that's actually a little disturbing to me in some ways, in that most of us, not everyone, but most of us don't spend that much time in nature. So it means we may not be as good at recognizing God's presence in all the other aspects of our lives, and how do we see God and experience God in the inner city or in the poor or in pain and suffering, because I think God is also very much there, and I want to say that from the beginning. I think too often people who are involved in outdoor ministries programs are too narrowly focused on that as the way to experience God, and I don't want to, in doing this session, give the impression that I think this is the only place to experience God's presence. Let me just give you very briefly some of my background, because I think that's probably only fair to let you know where I'm coming from. I am a quite avid climber and mountaineer and spend as much time in the wilderness as I can. Unfortunately, I came to Holden because I thought I was going to have all this time to hike and climb. And, I mean, for other reasons too, I came here because I really feel called to this kind of ministry. But this summer has not allowed me to do as much of that as I would like. At the same time, I, prior to coming to Holden, lived for 8 years in the inner city in Boston, really in an area that you would call a ghetto, and did work there. I lived there. I also worked there doing community organizing and a lot of youth work, and did a lot of coalition building around housing issues in the city. I was quite involved in city politics. And at the same time, as many weekends as I possibly could, or sometimes during the week, depending on my schedule, I would throw ropes and ice axes and whatever I needed at the time into my car and go to the mountains in New Hampshire. Much to the confusion of most of my neighbors. I didn't even know what most of this stuff was. So there has really been, for me, a real tension in my life, I think a creative tension, between living in the city and also being involved in a lot of issues like Central America. I've spent some time in Nicaragua. And being concerned about those kinds of issues, and at the same time feeling like I have to spend time in the mountains. So there are not that many people that I know that have had that much of a tension between two extremes sort of for a period of time in their lives. So it's been out of that that I have struggled to try to discover or be able to at least articulate a little bit for myself and then for other people what the connections are between those two different parts of my life. Because I know that there's a connection. I know that there is some way in which my experience in mountains empowers me and gives me strength for the other work that I feel called to do. And that empowerment, I've come to realize, is more than just rest. There's something more than just going to the mountains to get away from it all. And I think that's another common way in which most people approach being in the wilderness. And that's important. I don't want to deny that. But I think there's more to it than that. And that's what I'd like to really talk about today. These aren't necessarily particularly original ideas, but they are ideas that are original to me in the sense that I process them through my own experience. So we'll see what happens with it. So I hope that this will at least be some kind of context for understanding our experience of both being at Holden and when we do hike and get away into the mountains or other kinds of wilderness. I happen to be prone to mountains. That we can more fully experience the spiritual lessons that I think that are there. And I guess I should say that I do quite a bit of teaching at Holden. And this is probably, I've now done similar things to this a couple times and have played with this presentation a few different ways. And this is probably the most difficult topic for me to articulate. I mean, I've done stuff on urban economics and on third world debt crises and Central America, and those things seem to be a lot easier for me to explain. This, because I think it's so close to me in an emotional way, is much harder to try to get across. So I'll make another attempt and hopefully somebody will connect with what I'm trying to say. What I hope to do is, and I want everyone to feel free throughout the whole thing to ask questions, make comments, vehemently disagree with me, whatever you feels important to say. And there will be a lot of ways in which I'll try to get everyone involved in helping us move through this. I'd like to talk first a little bit about what wilderness is and what our perceptions of it are. And as part of that, what are the aspects of wilderness that are important in our spiritual lives? And then talk a little bit about wilderness in the Bible and relating to two particular experiences there and what we can learn from that. And then looking at how we, I think, tend to domesticate God, and I'll say more about that when we get there, and then how I think that experiences in the wilderness can help us break through that. And then we can end with just basically then what those lessons are for the rest of our lives, and hopefully I'm sure we'll have plenty of time for just seeing where people would like to respond. I also want to just say before I launch into this that I'm really excited about having those students here from Japan, because I really do believe that that my experience and the way I think is primarily comes out of a very Western way of looking at things, and I would love any comments or responses from any of you about whether this at all seems the way that people in Japan would think about this, or whether it's very different. I'm sure there's something we can learn from all of you. I also know that many of you went hiking yesterday to Heart Lake, so we'll see if that experience has added anything. Okay, let's begin. First of all, I just want to ask you, what do you think about when you think about wilderness? What are, and maybe more specifically, what are the characteristics of an area of land that you would then say was wilderness? I'd actually like to write some of that up here.
Isolation.
Okay, isolation.
Growth, place for growth.
Okay, all right. I'll tell you what, for right, your response is perfectly appropriate to my question, so the problem is my question. But what I'd like to do is maybe even move into those kinds of things in terms of what the wilderness can do for us. Secondly, right now, what are the characteristics without our interaction with it? Although I guess in some ways...
About no pollution.
Okay, I would wish that was true. I'm not sure that's true. That's not always the case. But certainly less so than other places.
Quietness.
Right.
Peace.
Okay.
Animals and birds.
Okay.
No crime.
Well, it says we got peace up here.
No crime.
No crime. Yes. Okay. Other things that we can think of.
Understanding if we see.
Okay. You think we always do understand
what
we see? Oh, all right. We'll put animals, we'll put plants there. Okay. All right. I think that's probably enough to get us started. I mean, those are pretty obvious. Really, and in many ways. I mean, I think most of the time if a group did this, the list would be somewhat similar. And you know, it may not be that everyone does feel isolation in the wilderness, but I think generally that would be part of it for a lot of people. A lot of people wouldn't necessarily feel danger all the time, but again, you know, it's part of it. And there's some parts of the wilderness that probably are not all that beautiful. You know, there are ways in which we could look at each of these and say, well, that's not always the case, but that's not exactly my purpose. But if we really wanted to define wilderness in a physical sense, a lot of people would define wilderness as a place where there are no motorized vehicles. This is sort of the legal definition of it right now in 1987 in the United States. And that there are no permanent human inhabitants. And certainly a lot of these things relate to both of those. I mean, hopefully the quiet and the peace and the no crime relates to those kinds of things. So I should just maybe say that in this country right now, we have sort of a general sense of wilderness as being areas that we think of like this. In a legal sense, we also have what are called designated wilderness areas. And in fact, we are in the middle of one right now. If you go less than a mile up the road, you enter the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area, which in fact almost surrounds us. The only part of this whole area that's not is simply the road in Holden Village, because we have a special permit. And those were created under the Wilderness Act of 1964, which set aside certain lands in the United States that would be protected very, very strictly. They are the most strictly protected lands in the United States. You cannot have... We had somebody, I'm embarrassed to say, but somebody on our staff... ended up taking one of our little golf carts up into the wilderness area, just didn't understand, even though there's a sign that says no motorized vehicles right there. This was about a month ago. The Forest Service fined him $50, which I think is absolutely appropriate. You cannot have any motorized vehicles in there. The Forest Service is now tearing down cabins and things like that have been in the wilderness area for a long time. There's a real effort to try to restore the land to as close to its natural condition as possible. So that's just some confusion sometimes when we hear, well, this is a wilderness area. Wilderness certainly also applies to areas that are not legally defined that way. But I also want to talk about what wilderness means, the word itself means, and where the history of that word comes from. the origin of the word really comes from Teutonic and Norse words, Teutonic or German and Western European languages back in the Middle Ages, where the will part of it comes from a word that really meant uncontrollable, and essentially then developed into the word wild, which is again uncontrollable, unruly, confused, those kind of thing. And dior, or the wilder, that part of it basically was an old English word that meant animals that are not controlled by humans. In other words, not domesticated animals, wild animals. So those two words together eventually came to mean our English word wilderness. And I think that's extremely important, because one of the aspects of wilderness which is extremely important, and this is the major focus that I want to take today, is that wilderness is a place that where we are not in control. I think that's what the root meaning of the word points us to, and I think it also, some of these things, no obvious signs of pollution, of humans, the danger aspect of it, for some people, but there's a sense in the wilderness where we are not in control, which I think is different from the way we do feel sometimes in other places. Now, that doesn't mean we always feel in control in the middle of the city. Believe me, I feel more in control sometimes in the wilderness than I did walking around the streets of Boston. But we're in touch with things that are not human-made in the wilderness. And it's there that we don't feel. We feel the lack of control when we're directly engaged with things that are infinite, essentially. Things that are not human-made. Whereas in the city, we're surrounded with concrete and asphalt and buildings that are all human-made. And I want to come back to that later, but just as a matter of a way of sort of setting that up. In addition, what are some of the other ways? Let's just talk for a second about some of the ways in which characteristics of the wilderness do relate to our own spiritual growth, which Sharon mentioned before. What are some of the things? I've already sort of begun that, really. But what are some of the ways in which you would, out of your own experience, you would say that the wilderness touches your in your spiritual lives? Right, and I think that, I really do think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have to directly be in touch with creation in a way that we don't when we're in urban areas or even in small towns a lot of times. I think that's different for people who are farmers very often. They have all that all the time. But yeah, sure.
Well, hopefully for me, that I'm stretched physically, I have to do something like
okay.
Hike along or swim far. The water's cold. Or it's harder to make a fire.
So, okay, so you're not only talking about physically in terms of exertion, you're also sort of talking about a different routine.
Yeah.
That's really breaks your routine life. Okay. I think that's absolutely true, because I really do believe that it's when we break through the routines in our lives that we experience growth. And the wilderness is a place to do that, Hans.
I think dependency and vulnerability.
Okay.
Another word would be connected with this idea of acute sense of our own finitude, our own limitedness. In other words, one slip and I'm dead.
Mm-hmm. Great, that's exactly what I wanted to get into.
Just
it wasn't even a plan. No, that's exactly what I want to focus on for most of the time, because I think that's what we often leave out. But are there other things? I wasn't just trying to search for that one thing and then leave it there. There are some others.
Barry, another interesting thing for me, and I haven't at all figured this one out, but since I like to climb too, it's this angle the incline.
Ah. Mm. Okay.
The incline. And what that means. See, we all are pretty level people. Or if we're on an incline, we're in a car.
I'm going to add decline, because you always have to come back down.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure about that one, but it's fascinating.
That's an interesting point, which I would love to think about more. Yeah. There's a great quote, which I can't, boy, I don't have it with me, that I really like, though, that it essentially says, why go to the top?
Yeah.
And the answer is not because it's there. The answer is more because it's, it says, why go to the top? Because when you come down again, you're just going to be back down again. It's about a 3-paragraph poem, and it talks about how, but once you have been to the top, you have seen, and you can remember what you have seen once you're back in the lower places. There's a sense that being there can give you a broader sense of what's around you than if you're in the valley and you can't see beyond that.
You might be inclined to do so.
You ought to get together with Tom Stilberg, our registrar. He's the master of puns around here. Anything else that anybody would like to add to that?
Well, there's a certain sense of a fulfillment or accomplishment when you have climbed that mountain and reached that goal.
Okay. All right. Let me just add one more here, and then we'll move on. I'm aware of the time here. There is a sense, what I would add to all of this up here, and which is related, is a sense of mystery. I mean, when you look at things in detail, when you look at a plan, or you can just look at mountains, there's a real sense of mystery there, which I think is different from our sense of mystery, again, in towns and cities.
Do you feel that a wilderness has to have mountains?
No, I don't. No, I happen to be biased in that direction. But I mean, the wilderness in the Bible is all desert.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's true. But I do think that all of these things, except maybe the incline and decline part, would relate to all areas of wilderness. Yeah. You're absolutely right. It's a good point. That's what we tend to think of here in the United States, probably more, but not necessarily. Okay, let's move on then. I think just to end this section, just to say that there's really a history of our conception and approach to wilderness within at least the Western world in the United States. And in fact, a fascinating book, if anybody's interested, is Wilderness in the American Mind. Mind, not mine, like copper up here. By Roderick Nash. And he's just revised this one, I guess, in the last few years now. But it goes all the way through the sort of European roots of the word and how people perceived wilderness, and then especially through our whole American history. And really talks about how wilderness has in the earlier part of our history really been a place to be feared and therefore to be opposed. It was something to be fought. It was something to be conquered and dominated for our own use. It was really seen as a negative thing. Wilderness was negative. When you civilized it and cultivated it, then it became good. So it's something that you're supposed to subdue. And then sort of in the midst of all that, there was a sense that wilderness was the place to prove your manhood. And it was manhood, not usually womanhood. And it's a place to become self-sufficient, to really do almost just the opposite of what we're talking about up here. It was a place in which you established your control. And I think there's still a strong element of that among a lot of people who climb and do other things. And now we're moving much more into a philosophy of wilderness where we really see a sense of connection, of interdependence, of a way of looking at wilderness as something that we have responsibility for stewarding, for taking care of, and which is a fairly recent way of looking at it, and even in Christian thought. Christian thought really supported these other things. We were to dominate wilderness. Now we're really talking much more about stewardship of creation and stewardship of the wilderness, and how we need to, that wilderness has a value in and of itself now, not just what we make of it. And that's really important. Now, with that as sort of background, just real quickly mention wilderness in the Bible and what we might be able to learn from that. The two examples I want to talk about are the two obvious ones for people who are familiar with the Bible. And the one is the experience of the 40 years of the Hebrew people after they have left Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. They have escaped from Egypt. And before they were actually allowed by God into the Promised Land, they spent 40 years in the desert in the Mount Sinai region. I think there's several things that we can really look at there that might teach us something about how our own experiences in the wilderness can help us and stimulate some growth. One is the question of who, again, who is in charge? Who is in control in those 40 years? Who is really taking care of things? God is. I mean, that is really clear. The manna comes out every morning. There's food on the ground. There's the whole sense of God being in control on Mount Sinai when the commandments are given. We could just go on and on about the fact that the people are not the ones in control there, that they are subject to responding to the wilderness and to the acts of God. And I think it's also important to look at that as God acts in very unexpected ways. The wilderness is a place in which the old is broken down, and God acts in new ways, and new covenants are formed. Even just the Ten Commandments, I'd love to talk about this particular part of it a lot longer, but the Ten Commandments were, we see them now as sort of rigid rules in many ways, unfortunately. The Ten Commandments at that time were a way in which God was saying, it is important for you to live as an alternative community, as a new community, not just as any community. You are a new community in the midst of cultures that are not peaceful and whole and promote a sense of wholeness. These commandments are part of your way of holding that community together. Little things like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, for instance, was a law that for us now sounds like a very, retribution is the word I want to use, but a law in which you simply get what you, it's punishment what you gave out, and we sort of use a contrast with Jesus's turn the other cheek. And yet at that particular time, that was a major breakthrough, because most cultures had no restrictions on what your punishment could be. You could commit a very minor crime and be killed for it. And an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was not saying you should always be punished for everything you do. It was saying the punishment should be consistent with the crime.